The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 109. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to the live stream. Hey Kulisia, today's my birthday. Happy birthday! Happy birthday to you. I know you guys are here to ask some questions, so let's dive into that. And for those of you who have thought about it, now is a great time to join Rebel Capitalist Pro. I always like to do my pitch for Rebel Capitalist Pro at the beginning of these live streams. Lynn Alden is just blowing up. Everyone loves Lynn. And Chris McIntosh is just an incredible veteran with some amazing insights, especially in the commodity space, which I think is pretty much the only thing that's cheap right now. So if you guys are interested in Rebel Capitalist Pro, check it out. That's the research. Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh. We've got an awesome members forum in there. I'm actually going to do a members live stream at 2 o'clock after I get done with this and eat lunch. And we've got just some incredible content. So check that out. It's georgegammon.com/pro. That being said, let's get right into the questions. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, so Niku Soren, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, asks if nat gas is cheap right now. Same question with coffee. Coffee, that's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure. You'd think I would know that, having just left Medellin, Colombia. I know Buffett just bought a big, I don't know if it was a nat gas company, but he went long there somehow. I remember seeing that. And I think McIntosh is pretty bullish nat gas as well. He's done a lot more research than I have, so I want to defer to his expertise. But just commodities in general, relative to the stock market, if you guys have seen that chart I've used in some of my videos, all-time historic lows. So not that they can't go lower or that they won't stay low for the next 2 or 3 years, but what we can say with 100% certainty is that historically speaking, adjusted for inflation, they are cheap. So Jim asks, can I see a time when Social Security is not sent out to out of the country to expats? I've never thought about that, Jim, but I think the political narrative in the United States is becoming more extreme, to say the least, not only on the left, but on the right. And it's every party is the party of bigger government. It's just a matter of how much bigger do you want the government? And I mean, I could see that. I don't know that the probability is high, but yeah, I mean, if we get a lot of people moving out of the United States, a lot of baby boomers, because they're like, number one, I don't want to be around riots. I don't want to be around looting. I don't want to be around social unrest. I've had enough of this. And I'm on a fixed income with Social Security. So why not go to a place like Medellin, where I would argue the standard of living is even better than most of the towns in the United States or the cities in the U.S. And your cost of living is 10% what it is in the U.S. And you've got the coast, you've got the Caribbean, you've got Santa Marta, you've got Cartagena, you've got all these places. And you're on the same time zone as the U.S. And it's a 3.5-hour flight to Miami if you want to go back. It's for me, if I was a 70-year-old person that was retiring and I was on a fixed income, it would be a no-brainer. I mean, why would you stay in the U.S. Unless you had like grandkids or something that they lived within proximity, that I totally get. But if your grandkids live in another state or your kids live in New York and you live in Florida, why not just move to Medellin? So now you got a 5-hour flight or a 6-hour flight instead of a 3-hour flight to see your kids or your grandkids. But you're only seeing them once every 3 or 4 months anyway. I mean, who cares? And I just don't think Americans understand how poor their standard of living is in the United States relative to what it would be in Medellin. I mean, in Medellin, if you've got $3,000 a month coming in, I mean, you've got a housekeeper, you've got a personal chef, you'll never do a day of laundry again in your life. You can go out to eat whenever, you can live pretty much wherever and whatever neighborhood you want. It's you just don't understand the lifestyle improvement. And anyway, so, but to your point, Jim, I see a lot of the politicians saying, hey, you know, these people are traitors. What are they doing? They're not patriotic. Why would they leave the United States unless they're doing something nefarious? They must be up to no good. And we don't want anyone that's up to no good having their Social Security. So I could totally see that in the future, especially if enough people leave to where that money isn't circulating in the United States anymore. It's circulating outside the United States. I think they could come up with some reason, some rationale as to why it's, number one, unpatriotic. Number two, only drug dealers and terrorists do that as far as leave the United States. And number three, they just say, you know, it's for your protection somehow. It's for your security. Sir, this is for your security. You know, that's how the banks and that's how everyone spins it nowadays. Oh, don't worry about this intrusion into your personal privacy. It's for your security. Okay, right. That's always code word for we're screwing you with a smile on our face. Henry asks, thoughts on Deutsche? I don't know if I've got any further thoughts on Deutsche other than the videos I've done, Henry. Everyone knows their balance sheet is a black box, the derivatives, who knows? I know they're trying to get away from retail banking, which I don't blame them because you've got a flat, if not inverted yield curve over there. And banks can't make any money if the yield curve's flat. Other than in their trading and everything, I don't like Deutsche, but I think they might get a bailout. But I mean, I think they could have been bailed out in part due to the repo bailout we had back in September. It's almost like we forgot about repo because we got bigger fish to fry with everything that's going on with the Cerveza sickness. And it's kind of taken our attention from one thing and put it over to another, but I'm sure at some point in time, the European banks will struggle again, and that will be headline news, whether they get bailed out or not. I think it's just an interesting thing to think about. I don't see any way to profit from it through a trade that would have any type of, other than just a gamble, which that's not what I'm all about. Yeah, Aldo asked me if I can comment on the Swiss franc versus USD. I don't really like any fiat currencies if you have to go into one. Maybe the Swiss franc or the Singapore dollar. I don't know. I don't really like currencies. I don't really like, it's just not cheap, although it's rather secure. I mean, if I'm going to have to buy a currency, I'd rather make it more speculative and buy like ruble denominated debt where I'm getting like a 15% return. But it wouldn't be an investment. It would be part of the portfolio that I've allocated to speculation only, which would be 10%. So it might be a 1% position maximum, but I would see it more of a speculation. Like I said, if you're just talking about going into a currency just to protect your purchasing power, I think the only way to do that is gold. That's just my personal opinion. GJ asks, what do I think about muni bond funds? I don't like them. I mean, the states are bankrupt. Look at when you look at their pension fund liabilities and they're insolvent, there's no way of them ever dishing out what they promised. And I'm just talking about the pension funds mostly, but that's going to trickle down into the states and property taxes. And I think that the muni bond funds, it's very similar to corporates in the sense that they don't have a liquidity issue. They have a solvency issue. They have a cash flow issue. And I don't see how that cash flow gets fixed. Now, of course, they could do a bailout and the government, the Fed, whatever, could print the money and give it to the local states. I think that's going to be challenging logistically, to say the least, but I just don't like buying stuff unless they're cheap, and there's nothing cheap about muni bonds, or at least when you look, in my opinion, when you look at it from a standpoint of risk reward, you might be able to get a little bit better of a yield, but this risk reward, I just think you got too much downside, especially when you consider inflation. I know you're probably asking the question because you're kind of stuck in a 401k, which I can totally sympathize with, But I don't really like it, other than if it's just you've got three options and the other two are worse options. Brendan asked, do I recommend dumping big oil stocks at this point? No, because that's not how I invest, Brendan. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just not what I do. And so why haven't I sold, or why won't I sell? Because they're not expensive yet. And if I ride them all the way back down to where I bought them, I'm totally fine with that. Or if they even go lower, totally fine with that. If they go lower, I'll buy more, unless there's something dramatically different about their balance sheet. But I just don't sell things. I don't try to lock in profits, or I don't sit there and say, oh my gosh, well, I think they're going back down now and I've realized a 30% gain, so I'm going to sell them now to lock in my profit. It's just not the way I think. And I'm pretty sure my brain has been hardwired to operate as an entrepreneur, as an entrepreneur that deals with small and mid-sized businesses. So I just see stocks as buying the business. And I would never buy Shell, as an example, with the intention of selling it like a month later. I wouldn't do that. Just like I wouldn't buy a McDonald's franchise with the intention of selling it in 2 months, right? Like if I bought a McDonald's franchise because it was throwing off, let's say, $250,000 a year in cash, and I could get good financing and my cash on cash return was solid, I saw maybe opportunity to buy more McDonald's franchises, build a human resources infrastructure, and to grow the business. If I got it on the cheap for whatever reason, and 2 months later it was valued by some random business broker for 30% more than I paid for it, but that broker said in the next 6 months it might go back down to the price you paid for it, would I sell? No, no, of course not, because I'm not buying a McDonald's franchise to flip it. I'm buying a McDonald's franchise to hold it to own it forever and give it to my kids. Or I'm not buying a McDonald's franchise to sell it. So I look at stocks the exact same way. I mean, since 2012, I've only bought stocks twice, and I've never sold any of them. So I still own them today. Baxter asks, did I interview Hugh Hendry? I have not interviewed Hugh yet, but I met him last night for drinks. And we went to this fantastic beach club down by the main part of town called, it was a beach called Shell Beach. And we were there, just great conversation. I met his amazing wife and his three super, super cool kids. And he was a great guy. And we were talking about content. We were talking about a little macro. We were talking about real estate. We should have recorded that conversation. But we definitely plan on doing some really cool content in the next few weeks. And I'll just leave it at that. I think you guys are going to be surprised, and you guys are going to absolutely love the content we create. And I'll just leave it there. But definitely stay tuned to the channel if you're a Hugh Hendry fan. And if you're not a Hugh Hendry fan, well, what on earth are you doing? You're crazy. You got to look at Hugh's stuff. He's really got some incredible insights into macro, that's for sure. XYZG asks, doesn't there need to be legislation passed to use the TGA? No, because you're not looking at the past legislation that's already been passed. You're thinking that as soon as the legislation is passed, that the very next day, like, they immediately spend the money. But that's not what happens. They can pass the bill, and then they can just not spend the money until, and let the TGA go up and up and up and up and up, and just keep collecting tax dollars, or, you know, issuing bonds, and that's how they're bringing money into the account. But they could just not spend that money, even though it's already been earmarked for specific projects. So they've got control. It's just like your bank account. That's the best example I can give you to help you kind of just understand it a little bit better. Like, let's say you've got, you rent a house and, or an apartment, and you owe rent for the next 4 months, but you don't necessarily have to pay it. I mean, you should, I mean, obviously you might get evicted or whatever, but assuming that that was off the table, you could just go to your landlord and say, listen, I'm not going to pay for the next 4 months, but in 4 months, I'm just going to pay you all at one time. And they say, yeah, that's fine. So yes, technically you, the rent that you owe has been earmarked, but you're not paying it out every single month. And therefore your checking account is going up and up and up and up and up and up until a point where you can spend it all at four months in the future after you've let it build up in your bank account. So why would they do that? Because they're doing that to potentially play around with the amount of bank reserves in the system. So they can do quantitative. So going back to the example I just gave you, if you could do quantitative tightening and quantitative easing of your own bank account, if you were spending the money, that would be quantitative tightening because those bank reserves would go down, using your checking account as an example. But if you saved the money, then that would be quantitative easing because there would be more bank reserves in the system if that ecosystem was just your own little or big checking account. So that's kind of how they can manipulate and do their own QE and QT, even though the money's been earmarked. Brian's asking me fixed rate HELOC to purchase metals. Oh boy. I mean, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm bullish gold. I obviously automatically buy it for insurance, as you guys know, but to take out a fixed rate HELOC where you've got to pay interest to buy something that's not throwing off any positive cash flow and actually has a negative carry in the sense that you might have to store it and whatnot. You got to pay a spread. I don't like that. I would much prefer to use a fixed rate HELOC to, and obviously assuming you can term it out over 30 years. If you can only fix it for 5 years, then it's a different story, but I'm assuming you can term it out 30 years. I only like that to buy an asset that is going to pay me more than I'm paying the bank and in the form of positive cash flow. So, and that's after my debt reduction. See, if you're not getting any positive cash flow, then you've got a strong negative carry to hold the precious metal because you're still making those payments to the bank with interest. So yeah, I don't like that. I'd much prefer to take out that loan to buy something that's going to pay me to own it so I don't have the negative carry and actually have a positive carry. Or said another way, so I'm not taking money out of my pocket to own it every month. I'm actually getting paid to own it, even when you include the amount I'm giving the bank in the form of interest.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, Klaus asks the same type of question. If I get out of gold stocks before the government starts taxes it more, nationalize it, what should I go into? I'm not sure I would factor that into my decision-making process right now. At least I'm not. I wouldn't really worry about that until the election. I think they've got bigger fish to fry, especially with the Cerveza sickness and everything that's going on in the United States, and just this like tension in the social fabric that is palpable. When I go to the U.S., it was so bizarre when I was back in Fort Lauderdale. Man, I've never seen anything like that. But I don't know that I'd really worry about that. And gold stocks, I don't think are expensive yet. I bought them back in March. I'm sure most of you guys bought them back in March as well. But they're definitely not even close to expensive, in my opinion. So I'm just not going to sell them. And I definitely see how they could nationalize it more or nationalize it. And I don't know if you're talking about the countries where the gold mines exist, or you're talking about, or the U.S. government just taxing it or confiscating. Yeah, they're not going to confiscate that. So I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that, Klaus, but I think my best answer would be I'm not personally selling my gold stocks because they're not expensive yet, in my opinion. And I'm not really hyper worried about government confiscation or increased capital gains tax, or maybe the mines themselves. I might be a little concerned with the nationalization of that due to the swap lines. Brent's talked about that. Marin Cattuz has talked about that as well. But I don't know if I'd be concerned enough to sell, at least not to the election. That's what I'm doing personally. You can take it for what it's worth. Well, Josh asks a question I would need a whiteboard to answer that, Josh. I can try to give you a quick Reader's Digest version. How do you feel about the consumer society we live in today? And how do you think that will affect the future of the economy? Well, I think there's a difference between being a consumer-driven type of economy and not producing the things the economy consumes. I know it sounds like I'm saying the same thing, but I think it's quite a bit different. What I'm very concerned with is the fact that the United States is very consumer driven, but we don't really produce any of the things we consume. The only thing that we produce are little green pieces of paper that we send to the people who actually do the producing, and they can use those pieces of paper to give back to us in the form of buying our debt, or they can give it back to us in the form of buying our assets. And at a certain point, do the foreigners own all the U.S. assets? I mean, obviously we're not there now, but mathematically it would be possible. I mean, when I say all, I'm not talking about 100%. I'm just talking about a lot. And I don't know that that's a great thing, because then you become, Americans kind of become like they don't own the country they live in. And I guess that's not, it all depends on your vantage point there. And capital should go where it's treated best. And I'm all for free markets. And I'm definitely in the belief system that if someone has the brain power and the capital to come in and create jobs and create industry, do things more efficiently, that we should allow them to do that regardless of where they're from in the world. I think it only benefits society at large, regardless of the economy. But I don't know. It's suboptimal. Let me just put it that way. As far as the way the U.S. has things set up. And how do you think that will affect the future of the economy? Also, too, going back to that question, Josh, you've got to ask how much consuming we would actually be doing if we didn't have the world reserve currency. And so if we're over-consuming as a society as a result, almost exclusively, of having the world reserve currency, meaning we can print money just like it's going out of style, and people will still buy our bonds denominated in our dollars and our currency, and we can use all that excessive debt that we otherwise wouldn't be able to afford, and we can use that to consume. That means that our stock market's probably higher than it otherwise would be, our real estate market, our asset prices, and our just consumption levels, because all that kind of trickles down, for lack of a better term. So if we were an Argentina, let's say, where if we took on an excessive amount of debt, that would reflect in our interest rates and in the bond market, then, you know, what does the U.S. consumption look like if asset prices are cut in half, if the Dow's at 15,000, if housing prices are back to where they were in 2012, and if interest rates are at 12%? And how much consumption would we have? I mean, when I was back in Fort Lauderdale, as an example, would all those big buildings, would all those big high-rise apartment complexes, would they have been built? Would they be in the process of being built right now? Would all those restaurants down on, I forgot the name of the kind of ritzy area down there, there's this one street with all of these cafes, shops, and restaurants, would they be in business? I forget the Cerveza sickness. Would they be in business if the stock market was it was half, if real estate was half, and if interest rates are at 12%? And you say, oh, George, 12%, don't be crazy. That will never, ever happen. Right. Well, you got to remember that Fed funds historically is 5-6%. So where does that take mortgage rates? I mean, 8, 9, 10. So we're not too far off there, just historically speaking, and not even going back that far. I mean, think about just before the GFC, Fed funds was 5%. So it's not a stretch to get there. So I think I've gone off on a tangent, Josh, and I apologize. But when you ask that question, that's kind of where my mind goes, is not just the fact that we're a consumer-driven economy, but why are we allowed to be a consumer-driven economy? What has given us that type of leverage? And is it realistic for the United States to have that benefit, not only moving forward, but indefinitely, for the next 100 years, for the next 200 years? Probably not. And as far as affecting the future economy, I think there'll be less consumption, because at some time you got to pay the fiddler. And at the end of the day, there is no production, or there's no consumption without production. It's like being stranded on a desert island with $1 trillion. What are you going to do? You got $1 trillion, but you still can't consume anything. Why? Because nothing's being produced. So you got to produce to consume. And if you overconsume for 40, 50 years, at some point in time, you're going to have to underconsume. I think that's where we go. And as far as, you know, then the next kind of question becomes Chris Cole's paper. So if you say that underconsumption that we're kind of due for, it's going to be a deleveraging. So is that an inflationary deleveraging or a deflationary deleveraging? In my opinion, it's going to be an inflationary deleveraging. So how do I see that affecting the economy? Number one, consumption. We have to underconsume for as much as we've overconsumed. And I see that happening through consumer price inflation over the long term. I'm not saying it's going to happen next year and in the 2 years. I'm saying 5, 10 plus years. Yeah, this is a good question. Eccentric asks, what are the other tactics the Fed have to save the massive evictions, foreclosures that are coming? Can the Fed prevent coming housing crash? Also, your thoughts on the 18-year cycle. I'm not sure what the 18-year cycle you're referring to, if that's like the Dalio short-term debt cycle. Also, your thoughts on the 18-year cycle. Or maybe you're talking about an 18-year housing cycle, but that would be correlated to Dalio's deal. Let me start with the first question. As far as can they save massive? Yeah, for sure, because they can take those loans and just put them on their balance sheet. Now, that assumes their balance sheet is infinite, which it is technically, but the P&L isn't. And I don't know if you guys saw that video I did. It was super popular about the Fed, and I can't recall the name of it, but I did it a couple weeks ago. And if you haven't, definitely check it out. What was it? I can't remember the name of it, but it was about the Fed and who owns the Fed and if there's a profit motive for the Fed. And if there is a profit motive for the Fed, which even by their own admission, they're privately owned. So why wouldn't there be a profit motive? And people say, well, they just get a 6% distribution or dividend and that's it. Not really. When you dig into it, it's not as crystal clear. It seems as though they set up these funds and where does that money go? And that they tried to do all these things to make sure that the government kind of minds their own business. And they say they're being audited, but they're audited by a government agency. And that's even if they are. And when Ron Paul did kind of a semi-audit, a private audit, there were a lot of skeletons in the closet, to say the least. So, but assuming there is a profit motive there, then the P&L would matter. And so you can say, yeah, they can take everything onto their balance sheet, which I've said many times before, and it doesn't matter if they take a haircut on it. But if that's from a balance sheet standpoint, if you look at it from a P&L standpoint, and they're taking massive losses because they don't have, the way that would happen is IOER would have to go to, let's say, 2%. That means the interest that the Fed pays on the bank reserves. The Fed pays the banks to hold money with them. So I think excess reserves right now are $3.5 trillion. Well, if you got to pay 3% on that, that's a pretty substantial amount of money you got to outlay. You need some positive cash flow. You need to pay those bills. And if everything on the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet goes tits up and they're not getting those cash flows because of there's no mortgages being paid, therefore there's no interest being collected, then they could have a negative P&L. And if there's a profit motive, then I wouldn't want the bank I owned, like if I owned the Fed, I wouldn't want it to lose money every single year if it was the profit was going into my back pocket. So my point there is yes, they could take everything onto their balance sheet to avoid massive evictions and foreclosures. And when I mean everything, I mean all of the mortgages. So if people didn't pay the mortgage, the Fed it doesn't care because they're the ones getting the payments. And so there's no real downside other than their P&L. And the reason I bring that up so many times is because nobody talks about their P&L. Nobody. Only people talk about their balance sheet. And I think that's maybe an incomplete analysis. So again, my thoughts on the 18-year cycle, I'm assuming you're talking about real estate. I don't know that I have thoughts on that specifically. I would just refer you to the chart that I use in most of my real estate videos that goes back to 1900, where it's adjusted for inflation and size. And you see that housing prices really don't go up. They just pretty much stay flat when you adjust for everything. The housing prices in the United States were the same in 2000 as they were pretty much in 1900, 100 years, and housing prices didn't go up. So contrary to popular belief, that's why I always say housing prices don't appreciate, they only inflate. And what I mean by that is they don't go up in real terms. They typically just go up in nominal terms. Carlos asks, in one of your videos, you mentioned you lost $2 million. Can you please explain what and how it happened? And you took yourself and succeed again to millionaire status. Oh, sure, Carl. I mean, I love talking about that. Who wouldn't like talking about one of the worst things that's ever happened to them in their entire life? But no, just Reader's Digest version 2009. The business I had started and was just poured everything into was doing real well. And I got into a battle with a politician, and it was the first time that I had done that. And I'm not going to name his name. He's still in politics, but the guy's as crooked as a scenic railway. I mean, he is a crook through and through. And he's done this several times, not just to me, But the bottom line is, I got into a battle with the guy and legal fees add up really quick and this and that. And the next thing you know, I mean, going into the, I can't remember the months exactly, Carlos, but I had probably $2 million at least in working capital. I think I had actually a little bit more for the business. And in 2 months, I was broke. Just dirt broke. And the business was doing a lot, had a lot of cash flow coming in. So I went to pretty well off to just super, super broke in about 2 months. But so how did I make it back? Well, I took on a couple partners to recapitalize the business because the business was still viable. And at that point in time, I fortunately, there's some gentlemen that I had known for quite a while. And so we had a lot of trust with each other and our ability. And I brought them on, instead of me making 100%, I went to making 33%. So we just split it three ways. And so I said, okay, if I was making, I mean, literally these are my thoughts. I said, okay, if I was making 100 grand a month before, owning 100% of the business, you know, how can I do that now? Only 33%. Well, I got to increase the profit. I got to increase the profit so I can make as much as I was making before, because I don't want to go backwards. It's just kind of there's a lot of psychological layers there, Carlos, but I'm not, obviously it's devastating to lose that much money. And it's definitely a gut check, to say the least. It's one thing to never have any money, but it's another thing to have a lot and to go back to being kind of poor. I mean, as an example there, I was living in $2 million condo. And 2 months later, I was renting an apartment for $600 in the ghetto. So when I say that I went from, you know, pretty high up to pretty low, I'm not exaggerating. But anyway, that the point is that that sucked. But I knew that I just had I had two options. You know, either you give up and just start bitching and moaning the rest of your life because the world's unfair and you hate politicians and blah, 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 blah. Or you can just say F it and F the politicians, F everybody, and just get hardcore and just become like, it's hard to explain unless you've been there. Just you become callous to everything. And you're like, F it. I don't care what I have to do. I don't care if I have to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if I have to travel all over the world. I don't care. I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to make it happen now. And anyone who gets in my way, they're gone. If they're an employee, if you're in my way, you're gone. I mean, just instantly. All, you know, friends, family, if they're not part of this mission, I just need to eliminate them. Not permanently, but just from my tunnel vision, if you will, until I can get this train back on the tracks. So then you say, okay, now once you get the train back on the track, so to speak, you're like, okay, now how do I make as much as I was making before? Well, I got to triple the profit. So then I had to, in order to do that, I had to grow the business substantially. And I took it overseas, and that's when I grew it into, with the help of my partners, I grew it into Australia, to pretty much every English speaking country in the world. And by 2012, I made it all back and more, for that matter. So that's the Reader's Digest version. There's a lot that I could go into. Maybe one day I will. But that's how you do it. Thomas is asking if I accept Bitcoin for Robo Capitalist Pro. We should. I mean, that's a great question, Thomas. I haven't thought about it, to be honest with you. I should have Sebastian and Gene look into that. Yeah, I don't know how we would do that, but there's got to be a way, because it's just a monthly membership. It's not like $1,000 a year or something like that, like most kind of newsletters. It's just like, it's either $57 a month or $97 a month, depending on what you choose. So I don't know how we could like auto debit Bitcoin. I'm sure there's got to be a way to do that. But I appreciate the suggestion. I should talk to Gene and Sebastian about that for sure. Question, what other tactics does the Fed have to save? Oh, wait, I already got that one. Okay. Okay, it looks like a lot of these are repeat questions. Yeah, Josh asks if when I buy real estate, I do it through an LLC. I do, Josh, but don't overthink that. Everyone kind of gets the paralysis of analysis. And I talk to so many real estate investors that are like newbies and they're trying to get into the game. And, you know, they're setting up their trust and their LLC and their this and that. And, you know, they're 20,000 into it, just setting up all these entities and structures just so they don't get sued. And they don't even have a property yet. Don't do that. Don't do that. It's much better to shoot first and ask questions later in this and in a lot of things in life, but especially with this. Yeah, if you want to set up an LLC real quick, just do one of those online things. Takes you, I don't know, a couple hours, a couple hundred bucks, and just set yourself up as the managing member. And you get an EIN number, set up the bank account, and then just buy the house or put it in the name of the LLC and just kind of be done with it. I really wouldn't worry about it too much. And if you own four or five properties, just keep them in the same LLC. You don't have to set up a separate LLC for all of them. It's, you know, maybe if you've got 50 properties, you want to set up three or four LLCs, but I wouldn't do it just for one or two. And don't let it get in the way of you buying a property. If you're like, if you got a property that where the numbers look good, you got a motivated seller, you got great cash flow, it's in a good area, all these things are lined up. Don't say, oh my gosh, I can't buy it right now because I don't have an LLC set up. Don't do that. Don't do that. It's not that, it's ideal, but it's not mandatory. So, and you can always do it later. You can always do a quick, you can quick claim deed it, what they call it, I believe, from a person into an entity. But just focus on the deal. You should be focusing 99.999% of your energy on the deal and just a small fraction on the LLC. If you're spending more than that on the LLC, it's taking up too much mental bandwidth. Dominique has an interesting question. California resident with dual citizenship in Colombia. Any areas of research that I should look into to utilize my Colombian citizenship? I don't think so, Dominique, because you know, just being from Colombia or having spent time there, that to buy real estate or assets, you don't have to be Colombian. I mean, I don't know why on earth you wanted your U.S. citizenship. Maybe you were a U.S. citizen first. It's just because, not again, I understand there's nice places in the U.S. and I'm from the United States, so obviously I'm pro-America, although I'm very sketchy about it right now, to say the least. But, you know, I want the America to be great. But the reason I say it kind of negatively from a citizenship standpoint is U.S. is going to tax you on your worldwide income, whether you're a tax resident of the United States or not. And you say, well, Colombia does the same thing. Right, but that's if you're a tax resident of Colombia, then you get taxed on your worldwide income. If you're not, if you're a Colombian citizen, but you're a tax resident of Dubai, then Colombia doesn't tax you, but the United States would. So I don't think too many foreigners understand that when they're gung-ho to get their U.S. passport and their U.S. citizenship, because it's such an anomaly. The U.S. is really the only major country that does that. So I don't think that people, you know, foreigners really think that through when they're like, oh yeah, I want to get my U.S. passport. I want to get my U.S. citizenship so then I don't have to apply for a visa or anything. Okay, but be careful what you wish for there. Money asks, what are my three macro books for investing? I don't know if I've got top three macro books. I don't know that I've really read any books on macro, like specifically. I've listened to audiobooks and read books on economics, but not really macro. As far as the macro stuff, I get most of my content from Real Vision or Macro Voices, or just trying to listen to any of the my buddies, you know, the guys that I really look up to and gals that are out there in FinTwit, you know, whenever they're doing an interview, regardless of whether it's on Macro Voices or Real Vision, I try to tune in and listen to it. So whether it's Snyder or Luke Roman or Hugh or Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh, I mean, Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna. I mean, you guys know the list. I'm sure I'm leaving out a ton of people. Schiff, even Rick Rule. And I like listening to Doug Casey as well, but more so for kind of the view on speculation and mining and personal freedom. But all those people I really like to listen to for their macro perspective. And then I also like to listen to a few more mainstream people that I like Gunlock. And I listen to Druckenmiller whenever I can. I always like to listen to Druckenmiller. And Mark Faber, I like a lot. Obviously, Jim Rogers is my favorite investor. So I just try to listen to interviews with those people and just to get ideas and to really kind of refine my thinking. And then also look for people to interview for the show, for the Rebel Capitalist show. And that helps me just ask them a lot of one-on-one questions that I've been thinking about when I actually hear their interviews. So I do that a lot. I don't know if you guys realize that. When I hear Groman, as an example, being interviewed on Macro Voices, and Eric's obviously one of the best interviewers out there. It's a lot better than I am. But we just have a little bit different styles. But if I'm listening to Eric interview Luke and Luke expands on something or has an idea, often I'll write it down. Like on my phone here, I've got that notes thing. And I've got, I don't even know if these guys know it. So, Luke, I'm keeping tabs on you, buddy. But whenever I hear something interesting that Luke says, it's with all the main people that you guys all know and like listening to, I'm just as much of a fan as you guys. So I've got a tab or a notes for Luke, and I'll just write one, and then I'll think of I'll just kind of write down the question. And then two, and I'll have like a list. So when I do interview them, I already have a list of like 5 or 10 questions that I've written down over the last month of listening to their other interviews that I wasn't really clear on. So that's one of the main things I like to do when I talk to people is get clarification on those questions I had from their previous content. So anyway, that's kind of how I get my macro information. And as far as investing books, I think you got to read Jim Rogers' stuff as investing books. Maybe not. I know he's got one like more for his kids or something, but his commodities books, investing books. I think you have to read Market Wizards. I mean, it's just mandatory. Read the Market Wizards books because they're not only going to give you insight as to how successful investors think, but they're going to give you insight on portfolio management, on probabilities, going back to blackjack. And I just think it's mandatory reading. As far as then blackjack, of course, I'd read Beat the Dealer by Ed Thorpe. But I'd start there with the investing books. And then I'd read Graham's Intelligent Investor too. What else? I'm not sure. That's pretty much where I'd start as books, but I'm more of a podcast person. I like podcasts and interview videos, and I much prefer that to physical books. So I think that's the best advice I can give you.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
James asked, am I a Ron Paul fan? I'm a huge Ron Paul fan. I'm a big time Ron Paul fan. In fact, I've been traveling for the last week. Prior to that, my buddy Jason Brook hooked me up with quite a few contacts of people that I've been trying to get on the show. And so once I get settled in, and I like I said, this is more of a hotel room. I'd like to get kind of an established place here, like a monthly rental. And once I get all that set up and like a whiteboard, I'm going to go out to the bookstore tomorrow and try to buy a whiteboard and get set up at the gym and all these things. Then I'm going to hit up the contacts that Jason gave me. And one of them is definitely Ron Paul to get on the show. So I'm super excited about that. Omer asks, as he's a contractor, should he take the PPP loan? I can't answer that question for you, Omer. I think that's a personal decision that you need to make. I mean, if anyone takes a PPP, I don't fault them for that. Not at all. I mean, you're a taxpayer. you put into the kitty. So why, if you're in dire straits, why shouldn't you take the money that you've put in for, kind of? I personally, unless I was just in absolute dire straits, I wouldn't do it, just because I just don't like dealing with the government. Even if they're giving me something I don't like, I prefer that they just weren't there. And I just try to live my life with as little government as possible. So that's just me. I don't think it's, I think you just need to make that decision on your own. It sounds like you're talking about it from like a moral standpoint and an ethical standpoint. And I can't make that decision for you. I can tell you that if you decline it, I would respect that. If you take it, I would respect that too. I think you just got to do what's going to make you, proud long-term. And that's different for different people. No, I don't think there's a right or wrong there. So Jim Rogers is not in bed with Soros, by the way. That's no offense, Danny, but I think that's kind of an ignorant statement. And I mean no disrespect by that, but if you studied Jim Rogers since the 1980s when he retired from the Quantum Fund with Soros, what you're talking about, there's no connection with the two. And I'm not saying Soros is good or bad or any of that. I'm not going to get into that. Go down that rabbit hole on this live stream, but there's no connection with Jim or I'll take it a step further. And this didn't happen with me, but other people that I know that have interviewed Jim, one of his prerequisites to being interviewed is that you don't talk about the Quantum Fund. You don't talk about he's just sick and tired of talking about it. And I think that he just wants to talk about stuff he's doing. He hasn't really, been involved with Soros for, let's see, I mean, my goodness, 40 years. So why talk about it, you know? Oh, Eric, here we go. I got it. What kind of watch did I get for a collection? And does it cost to store my trucks? It does. It does for my trucks. I've got about 100,000 worth of diesel trucks, as a lot of you guys know, and they're stored in Tucson in an RV type storage place. It's a low cost. It's maybe $100 a month, something like that. It's just kind of an outdoor area that's meant to park an RV, but I've got a few trucks there just that are covered and super low mile. In fact, I think all of them are under 100,000 miles, and they're all between 95 and 2002 power strokes. So I've just got them sitting there, just I guess literally collecting dust. But it costs you like $100 a month, something like that. As far as a watch, yeah, I talked about that the other day on a live stream, because I interviewed someone the other day for the Rebel Capitalist show, and they talked to me about how they not only buy gold to reserve and maintain purchasing power, but they also buy watches. Now, most watches depreciate just like cars, but if you know what you're doing, then there are certain watches that are notorious for maintaining their purchasing power and going up with the rate of inflation, just like some collectible cars. And I thought watches were an interesting thing because, you know, I mean, just the ordeal that I've been through over the last week, where I go from Medellin to Fort Lauderdale to the Virgin Islands to San Juan, Puerto Rico, then finally to St. Bart's yesterday. That's a lot of travel. And every single time, you know, of course, they're asking you if you've got over 10 grand. And if you do in cash, you got to say that, yes, you do, or whatever. But if you're wearing a watch that's worth more than that, I don't really think you have to claim that if you bought it in the United States and you're just wearing it around your wrist. No TSA agent's going to give you a hard time about that. Same thing with jewelry. I think that's kind of an interesting option as well. But I did a bunch of research on it for about a month, and I found one that I believe is collectible, and I bought one that had the box and the original papers and all that stuff just to kind of try it out and see how it works. So what kind of watch? It was a Rolex. It was a Rolex Sea Dweller, James Cameron. And I'm not sure what year it is, but that's the one that I decided to buy to start that collection, just kind of like having a gold bar or something like that. You know, travel with it. You've got a quick, I don't know what I could sell it for, maybe 10, 15 grand, something like that. So here's, I'll end on this one. This is a tough question. This is going to be one that I've got to think through. This is actually kind of a whiteboard question, but I'll try to tackle it. Blue Planet asks, if the Aussie Reserve Bank, which is their central bank, I believe, hopefully I'm making that assumption correctly, draws from the U.S. swap line 500 million increments per month, do you think it will affect the exchange rate? If so, any idea how much it will affect any lag time? So I'm assuming by your question that they're not just putting they meaning the Fed, isn't just setting up a swap line at the Fed, but the Aussie Central Bank or one of the commercial banks or several of the commercial banks in Australia are actually using the swap line. Now, I don't know if, so you're saying that the Reserve Bank is drawing against it. So they would need, I don't know. It really depends on what they're doing with the 500 million. If they're just, where does the money go? That's what Mark Faber talks about all the time with inflation is you just can't tell. Is it going into asset prices? I mean, what if they're just using it as a buffer and they're just really not doing anything with the money? They've got the dollars and they're just giving, you know, they're printing up Aussie dollars. So is the Fed using those Aussie dollars? Probably not. If they're using the dollars, let's see, they could, I don't know if I could, I could tell you with a whiteboard how it would work and where the money might flow. And if it flow, you know, if it went into the, if those dollars, let's see, they've got reserves, they might use that to back additional loans from the banks. That goes into the commercial lending, that goes into the economy. Those are dollars. That's dollar denominated debt. That means more dollars out in the system. I can see a way that it would reduce the dollar. So in other words, the Aussie dollar goes up relative to dollars because there's more dollar, but I could see it not affecting it. And I could see a situation where I don't know that it would decrease. Yeah. Yeah. Assuming they're using it, I don't really, just right off the top of my head, I don't see a scenario that would lead to the Aussie dollar going down. I do see a scenario where it would go up. But as far as the probabilities, I have no idea. And keep in mind, Blue Planet, that's with me just trying to think this through right off the top of my head. in a matter of like 2 minutes on a live stream. So, and another thing you got to understand with Forex is there are so many cross currents that I could sit here and think about this question for the next 3 hours, and I would have only addressed maybe 50% of the total cross currents that could play into the Aussie dollar versus the dollar. So that's one thing that makes currency, like guessing the direction of a currency, so difficult. You can really only do it if you get this major trend. So you've got this cross current that's so powerful that it's like a tsunami. It's just going to wipe out all the other cross currents, regardless of there's something that's kind of confronting it. It's just like this tsunami that's taking everything over, regardless of the resistance to it. When you don't have something like that, and it's just kind of an ocean of all these things intertwining and pushing and pulling, it's very, very difficult. So I know that's not a very good answer, but I think that's as good as I can do under the circumstances. So hopefully I get an A for effort on that one. Let's see. David asks, can I find an experienced, trustworthy lawyer in Colombia? I'm a real estate investor. Yeah. You got to kiss a lot of frogs, David, but you got to kiss a lot of frogs in the States too, especially with lawyers and accountants, as you probably know. But yeah, if you have a question on that, just email Sebastian. He can give you the name and contact for the guy we use. The guy's name is Santiago. I believe. I haven't talked to him for a while. He's a good kid, and he speaks English, and he knows his stuff, and he's right down in the Golden Mile, right there off of Poblado Avenue, his office. And he also works with a gringo whose name is Joe from LA, who doesn't practice down there, but he kind of mentors them. He's a big lawyer in LA. So just email Sebastian or my assistant. I think the email address they're using now is contact@georgegammon.com. And lastly here, we'll go with Rand, because I don't get this question too often. So I'll try to give my best tips for growing a YouTube channel. Did posting videos on social media work? Try to figure out some tips. Okay, Rand. So I think that it's a good thing to post on social media. I always post my new videos on Twitter, but it's not going to be the key to growth if you're looking for it on YouTube. You got to figure that. I mean, there's 2 billion people on YouTube. So your main targeted area for growth should be the YouTube platform itself. There's plenty of people on there to grow a channel. So the best tips I can give you are just to really get hyper-focused on your back-end analytics. That would be your click-through rate. That would be your retention rate. And just understand that if you're getting a real good click-through rate, and if you're keeping people on, I mean, if you're keeping 50% of the people on the video till the end, and you're doing like 10-minute videos, that's awesome. That's really, really good. And if you can get like a 60 to 70% retention rate over like a 8-10 minute video, and like a 20-30 minute video, if you can get like a upper 50s or maybe even a 60% retention rate on that, it's just a matter of time before the YouTube algorithm is going to pick up your channel, and they're going to push you out to more and more people. That's the way it works. It doesn't happen overnight, because you got to think of it from YouTube standpoint. They want, if you're just a brand new creator, they don't want to push your stuff out, because they don't know if you're just going to quit in a week. And if you get all these subscribers and you quit in a week, well, then that's not really good for their platform, and that doesn't help them achieve their objectives, which is to keep people on YouTube as long as possible, so they see as many ads as possible, And that's how YouTube's making their money. So in my experience and what I've heard from a lot of guys like Miles Beckler, I always talk about him, and the guys at Video Creators and Video Influencers and Nick Niman, Brian G. Johnson, all those people that I listen to, and I still do, to try to improve my YouTube game, they all are pretty, they all agree that you got to make a lot of videos for like 3-4 months before the algorithm even knows you exist. And then all of a sudden it'll pick you up, send you out to more people. And if those people are enjoying your videos, and you can see that through the backend analytics I was referring to, then it's going to, then YouTube's going to send your videos out to more people and more people and more people. And it's just going to keep doing that and doing that and doing that until the people that it's putting the video in front of aren't clicking on it anymore, because there's just so many people that are interested, in my case, in macro videos, or there's just so many people that are interested in an interview with Peter Schiff. So the algorithm just gets to a point where it doesn't push it out to any more people because it's exhausted all the people that are interested in that video. And how do they know that? By the people actually clicking, the click-through rate and the retention rate. So with my channel, as an example, I've produced videos for like 3-4 months nonstop. I was doing like 5 whiteboard videos a day, and the whiteboard videos were only getting like 20 views, and it sucks. That's the hard part of YouTube, is just having confidence in the system. But as you guys know, I always go back to blackjack. And it's been a huge advantage in everything I've done in my life, whether it's business, investing, and now YouTube, because I knew that I had the ability to ignore the outcome. So if I did a video that only got 20 views, I had the ability to completely ignore that. Like, 20 views, I don't care. Because that's not the metric I'm using to determine whether or not I'm successful. I'm using the click-through rate. I'm using the retention rate. And as long as my retention rate's high and my click-through rate's high, I don't care how many views I got. I get 0 views. I don't care. Because it's just like blackjack, in the sense that it's about the process and it's about doing it correctly. It's not about the outcome. Because if you focus on the process, then the outcome is going to take care of itself. So my point is, I don't know, for 3-4 months, I was getting no views. I had like, I think after 3 or 4 months, I had maybe like 200 subscribers, and the channel, the entire channel, was getting like maybe 50 or 100, 200 views a day. And then within the matter of 3 days, 4 days, the channel went from getting 200 views a day to 50,000. And I'm not exaggerating, literally. It went from getting 200 views a day to 50,000 views a day. And it's just like all those guys that I referenced earlier. It's just like they say, the algorithm just finally found it. And it's like, wow, this guy has been producing great content. We trust his channel because he's been producing these videos every day for 3 months. So we know he's probably going to stick with it. And when we do shoot his videos out, people like him. His click-through rate's high, his retention rate's high, everything looks good. So we're just going to send out more of his videos and just push him. And the rest is history. So that's the best advice that I can give you on growing a YouTube channel, is get hyper-focused on your back-end analytics. Ignore the results, the amount of views or subscribers. And keep doing it, stick with it. And then also listen to those guys, watch videos from Miles Beckler, Video Influencers, Video Creators, Nick Niman, and Brian G. Johnson. I think that those are the best guys and gals in the space. Okay. I was 16 minutes over. I got to remember time for lunch. All right, guys. So go check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. If you guys are late, I mentioned it at the top of the video. I'm partnering with Lynn Alden. and Chris McIntosh. It's their research. We've got a member forum on there for your questions and just interacting with the community. It's fantastic. And we do live streams with Lynn and Chris, where they actually go over their research and they answer your questions. And every once in a while, yours truly gets on there and does a live stream Q&A as well. I've got one here in about 45 minutes. So check that out. It's at Rebel Capital, or excuse me, it's at georgegammon.com/pro. I appreciate you guys being on till the end. We had over, I think, 1,200 people. Let me give some shout outs. We got Mark, thank you for being here all the way to the end. Andrew, thank you. Hone, thank you. S. Sun Kite, thank you. Ultimate Bargains, thank you. You're always here. I appreciate your support. Carrie, thank you. Isaac, done sailing. Yeah. Well, we're going to start sailing here in St. Bart's. That's what everyone does. Albert, thank you. Antonio, Brendan, Kite Guide Brazil. And I'm going to start kite surfing here in St. Bart's. That's on my to-do list. I'm super excited to learn how to kite surf. I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie guy, so that's right up my alley. Dave, thank you. Iggy, BC, Samir, Rickster, Mike, Pop, Corey, Donald. Thank you, everyone, for staying till the end, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.